If you were around in the 1970s, you probably remember kids' clothes being a sea of rainbow colours and those denim overalls for boys and girls. But sometime in the 1980s, it started to change very quickly, in fact. Pink became a girls' only colour. Shop aisles filled with miles of pink frills still are. Meanwhile, blue was reassigned as a boys' colour, apparently. In the last couple of years, there also have been some well-publicised backlashes to our colour-coded classification, with a few high-profile cases around the world of parents trying to raise a child without revealing their gender. So when did these powerful rules defining gender in children's clothing get laid down? Was the unisex clothing of the 70s just a fleeting backlash? My next guest has explored the fascinating and, as it turns out, very fluid history of colour and gender in kids' clothes. And she joins me this morning. Jo Paoletti is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland and author of Pink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America. Welcome to ABC Radio National, Jo.
Thank you so much, Natasha, and good morning.
And good morning to you. What first drew you to this issue? Where did the intrigue stem from for you?
Well, I got into it first studying men's clothing, oddly enough. I was very interested in how masculinity was defined and the rise of the business suit in the 19th century. And then I went from there to little boys' clothes because I couldn't figure out how the man was wearing a business suit and his son was wearing a little velvet little Lord Fauntleroy suit. And then I just, that question popped into my head, well, when did we start using pink and blue? And I thought it was going to be an easy question. I figured someone else had already done all this research and I could just look it up. And of course, that was 30 years ago. Someone else had not done the research, and so I had to do it.
Well, let's reach back into time. But before we do that, let's start in the womb, because this rush to start the process of gender identification starts right in the womb now. I mean, of course, with powerful ultrasounds, most people find out the sex of their baby halfway through the pregnancy, and this starts to shape their decisions, doesn't it?
It does. And it's, when you think of it, that just goes back to about 30 years ago, because ultrasounds were not all that common before the mid-1980s, at least in the U.S. And the ultrasound will tell you just one thing about the child, and that is their chromosomal, their biological sex. But just knowing that doesn't tell you really all that much. But it's a start, apparently, for people to start building the whole consumption pattern on and decorating the nursery and buying the clothes. I wonder if instead of knowing whether they're a boy or a girl, you'd know whether or not they had red hair or blonde hair. That would go off in different directions.
Yeah. Let's go back to the 19th century then, because this was a time where, in fact, all babies and toddlers, all of them, wore white dresses. And there was this sort of idea of the baby as effectively a sexless cherub, wasn't there? What did you find out about that time?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, their notion of gender and sex was obviously quite different from our own. First of all, they would probably find it very uncomfortable if they all of a sudden traveled in time to today and discovered little men and little women, infants, because to them, a little baby did not have sex and was not supposed to know about sex or be aware of it. And one way that you forestalled that was to dress them alike for as long as possible, which was typically until somewhere between 5 and 7 when this child started school.
And it was all white.
For the most part, for babies it was. For the first year of life, it was just so much easier to wash and boil white cotton than anything else. As toddlers would be more likely to wear colors, but they would wear the same colors that adults wore, and a lot of their clothing was more reminiscent of adult women's clothing in the way it was cut, the trims, the collars, the style of the sleeves, because it followed women's clothing rather than men's fashion.
And in the 19th century, when then was it considered appropriate? What age was it considered appropriate for children to start to wear this sort of a kind of more gendered clothing, a kind of demarcation according to their gender?
Well, the big change happened actually for boys rather than girls, because girls' dresses just got shorter as they got older. whereas a boy would go from wearing a dress to wearing some form of trousers. And the term for this was being breeched when you put away your dresses and started wearing trousers, which again was somewhere around the age of five, give or take. It depended on the social class of courts and what region of the country you lived in.
So we don't have any hints of pink and blue in this history yet. Let's then come to where this all stems from. When and why did things really start to change in ways that you found especially interesting? It seems to be related to the growth of a whole stack of psychological theories about gender and the birth of psychology, in fact.
And in fact, the idea of pink and blue color coding, or some kind of color coding, it ends up being pink and blue, is only one of a whole range of things that we use to gender clothing. And they all arrive at about the same time. Whether or not there's lace or embroidery, the use of cats on clothing for girls as opposed to dogs for boys, and that sort of motif. It starts happening discernibly in the early 20th century. I say discernibly because there are all kinds of little bubbles and ripples that happened before then, but so much of it appears to be fashion and not cultural change. And by that I mean it might be in style one spring to dress girls in pink or to dress boys in pink, but it's clearly in the fashion magazines presented as this is the style right now. It's kind of a whim. It's not a moral imperative.
That changed, though, didn't it? And at some point, there became a collective anxiety that we must be able to discern the gender of a child very early on. Where did that anxiety stem from?
That comes fairly quickly at the end of the 19th century from the new experts in child psychology, who are very much influenced by the theories of Sigmund Freud, who believed that those early years of life that adults can't remember are very important in forming identity, in forming attachments, in forming sexuality. So that they go in really the span of one generation from believing that children should not be aware of sex, and you don't need to teach gender because it just emerges from within the child without prompting, to children are more aware of sex than you think they are, and they can get the wrong idea or the right idea, and it's the parent's job to make sure that they have the right idea about what sex they are and how they are to behave and what that means.
Well, all this was real. I mean, there was a strong idea, wasn't there, that gender neutrality could lead to sexual perversion.
Oh, yes.
So kids...
Or confusion, yes. That if you delayed a boy's transfer into trousers too late, and a lot of times that was connected with this idea of having a more dominant mother, a mother that would resist putting her little baby into trousers, that this was one of the things that led to homosexuality. The other thing that's confused in here is the idea of little concern about little boys masturbating. And there's a whole kind of outrageous conversation going on in the psychological community at this time about whether, for example, wearing pajamas versus nightgowns to bed for little boys was more or less likely to encourage that. So, but they connected masturbation with homosexuality. It was all just forms of perversion. But having a healthy sex life meant not only a heterosexual sex life, but one that was directed towards having sex only with adult women when one was of age.
It's so intriguing to me that all this investigation of pink and blue has led to this incredible history. Was pink ever a colour that was specifically associated with girls and blue with boys up until this stage?
No. If anything, that's why it seems to take so long. Just different parts of the country, populated by different groups of people coming over from Europe, they had different traditions. The clothing industry was not entirely settled on which it should be. So there was a fairly well-publicized study that Time magazine did in the 1920s, where they surveyed department stores all over the country. And in Chicago, for example, Marshall Field, the major department store there, it was pink for boys, whereas in Boston, it was blue for boys. So depending on where you lived in the country, as late as probably the 1940s, you might have believed that blue was a boy's color, and blue was a girl's color, and pink was a boy's color.
Huh. And there was also the patterns of immigration in America too that really shaped this, wasn't there?
Absolutely, because there were parts of, for example, as late as in the early 1980s, there were still very small pockets of Catholic German groups in the Midwest, the United States, for example, in Nebraska, where blue was a girl color. They probably didn't care so much about pink or some other color for boys, but the association of blue with the Virgin Mary made that a more likely girl color in some Catholic communities.
How intriguing.
And that was also the case in Belgium, yeah.
How intriguing. Joe Paoletti is my guest this morning on the program, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland. She's written a book, Pink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America. Joe, when then did pink become a girl's colour, blue a boy's colour? This drives me batty when I'm trying to buy clothes for friends' children. I'm not a fan of pink at all, nor baby blue for that matter. So when did it begin? Why did this classification become so entrenched?
Well, there's no one point where you can just say they flipped the switch and here it was, because I would say that for most of the country, by the late 1940s, early 1950s, it was pink for girls and blue for boys. But you still find exceptions here and there. And I think the way I interpret that is that it wasn't considered a horrible sin to use pink on a boy, especially a very young boy, or as was very commonly done, using pink and blue together. So a shower gift, a gift given to a baby before it was born, could be pink and blue. Whereas today, the neutral shower gifts have neither pink nor blue. But if you look at the Walt Disney version of Peter Pan that came out in 1953, the youngest child, Michael, is wearing pink pajamas throughout the entire film.
Huh. I think that's you suggest that it looks like it's been recolored since.
It has. I haven't seen the whole DVD, the released version, but on the cover, he's wearing blue pajamas.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? You argue, provocatively it has to be said, and you've copped some flack for this, that pink didn't acquire its potent symbolism until after the second wave feminism of the 1970s, which is an interesting irony. What's your argument here?
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes I get accused of blaming feminism, which for someone who considers herself a fairly strong feminist is a horrible accusation. I would say I connect it, and it was inadvertent, really. But a lot of the messages of the second wave feminist movement were really against a lot of the symbolism of traditional femininity. And pink was one of those things. It was not the great Satan, where pink is awful, but it was just something to be avoided. And there are a lot of articles at the time also lambasting makeup and high heels and everything else. But for some reason, pink ends up being so strongly associated with traditional femininity at this time that when there's a bit of a backlash in the 1980s and people want to reclaim traditional femininity, it's almost like it's the most obvious thing to reclaim.
Why pink?
Why pink? it's funny because the unisex era coincides with a whole lot of other things that are going on. Like one of the things that happened, even if you weren't a feminist parent, there were a lot of studies that at that time that showed that infants didn't see pale colors very well, that they reacted more and enjoyed more high contrast colors and primary colors. So there's a trend in the 1970s towards non-pastels that kind of coincides with this anti-pink thing. So pink just disappears. There are a couple of years in the mid-1970s, a lot of the research I do is mail order catalogs. And the major one in our country is Sears Roebuck. And there's about three seasons worth of catalogs where there's no pink for toddler girls at all.
Wow.
So in some ways, it's almost like there's this pink starvation later on of, well, I don't see what's wrong with pink. I like pink. So the people who like pink start to want it back. the other thing that happens, I think, and this is a little harder to prove other than just to lay out the demographics, is in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, you have the baby boom generation fading as being the primary parents of firstborn children. So it's the baby boom parents in the 1970s who are embracing unisex clothing or the primary colors or whatever and rejecting everything that looks anything like the 50s. The primary parents in the mid-1980s now are people who were actually children in the late 60s and early 70s.
And rejecting what their parents did.
Yes, exactly, exactly. There's that undercurrent always of this intergenerational interplay between parents and children and the grown-up children becoming parents and saying, well, I always wanted a Barbie, so now I'm going to get a Barbie, and I always wanted to wear a pink party dress, so now my daughter is going to have pink party dresses.
And I know the tension well. It's obviously a tension, though, between individual parents and their decisions, but also there's a mass marketing, the power of mass marketing is going on here too, and pink is a big... Mm-hmm. A big marketing extravaganza. Do you think that pink-blue dichotomy is here to stay for good?
Well, between being a fashion historian, and that means I study both fashion and I'm a historian, I have to believe that things always change. To give you an example, there was a time in the 19th century wearing black pretty much as a woman would signal to everybody who knew you that you were in mourning. And now you can wear black and nobody says who died. So color symbolism especially can be something that can change. What needs to change in order to really get rid of the negative things that people associate with the pink and blue, I don't think they're objecting to the colors as much as to the underlying message, the gender stereotyping and all that, is if we finally start looking at children as individual human beings, and, excuse me, realize that we are raising humans and not little men and little women, and that we stop essentializing children in that way.
You're definitely.
And I think that will take much longer than any color changes.
You're definitely advocating for more choice in children's clothing, and I'm interested to see that you're writing another book on clothes and older women, charting that history as well, so the opposite end of the spectrum. Terrific to have you on the show to provoke our thoughts on this one. Thank you, Jo.
You're welcome. It was a delight talking to you.
Jo Paoletti there is, Paoletti, beg your pardon, is Associate Professor in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, and her book is called Pink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America, although I suspect it's a universal story, and it's published by Indiana University Press. Details on the Life Matters website. Coming up, storytelling on the stage. We're getting spooky.